Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of future exists for U.S. immigrant students brought to the country illegally as children? An estimated 65,000 teenagers who graduate from U.S. public high schools each year reside in the country without legal documentation. Many have no memory of living anywhere but the United States, and by law, they could be enrolled in public schools through 12th grade. But the benefits of free public education end abruptly after that, so that even the best and brightest students find themselves facing dead ends in trying to find jobs or continue their education. Journalist Helen Thorpe's new book profiles four Denver honor students from immigrant families, two undocumented, one with a green card, and one a U.S. citizen. All of them had lived most of their lives in the U.S. and qualified to study at prestigious universities. But despite strikingly similar backgrounds, their paths diverged sharply as they neared adulthood. Helen Thorpe has previously written for The New Yorker and for Texas Monthly. Her new book is called Just Like Us, the true story of four Mexican girls coming of age in America. Helen, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
So these four girls that you followed met each other in eighth grade, and at the time, they seemed to have pretty much everything in common. Can you talk a little bit about their friendship?
Sure. They were all incredibly bright students, and teachers were beginning to steer them within a year once they entered high school into advanced placement classes. And in all four cases, their families had immigrated from Mexico, and at home they spoke primarily Spanish. But they were excelling in English language classes at school. And they so they shared kind of a dual culture or a dual heritage, and yet they were doing really well in American society given where they were at the time.
And when they were steered into these advanced placement classes and sort of told you should be on a college track, they planned their future accordingly.
Yes, and the teachers with the best of intentions, you know, standing at the front of the classroom would often say to them, anybody in this country can go to college. Everybody in this room belongs in college. So they took those exhortations really seriously, and they thought that they belonged in college, and they began to sort of aspire to professional careers.
So the thing that they didn't have in common was legal status. One was a citizen because she'd been born here and then gone back to Mexico, but basically was a citizen for being born here. Another had papers, and two were completely undocumented.
Okay, I have to compliment you because it is confusing, and you're the first person interviewing me who could remember all the facts about the four of them.
Well, I read the book, so.
Yes, thank you. That's absolutely right. The foursome was split down the middle in terms of their legal status, and it does have a sort of complicated background, but one girl was born here, one got a green card, and two were never given documents by their parents and had no way to change their status here, given the laws that apply. And interestingly, I think, you know, they ran into this just at the same moment in time. It's the coming of age period, and everybody can remember what that's like. It's just at the same moment in time when they are, you know, dating their first boyfriends and figuring out whether or not they're going to try alcohol or go to parties or go to nightclubs and what kind of future they envision for themselves as adults. It's a very complicated moment in life, and that's when people who have legal status in our country earn all kinds of rights and privileges, like the right to drive or the right to vote. And the two undocumented girls were suddenly learning they weren't going to be able to do those things, unlike their two legal friends.
Yeah, it's really interesting because you introduce us to these girls on what was their senior prom night, and they have all the silly little worries that the teenage girls do when they're going off to prom. But that's sort of a thin veneer of carefree worries on top of really sort of existential questions for them.
Yeah, well described. And actually, the girl who emerges as, I think, the main character of the book, Maricela, is getting her hair done by a friend of the family who's a professional hairdresser, and the hairdresser asks her, in that moment, getting ready for the senior prom, well, what are you going to do after high school? And, you know, the hairdresser is clearly surprised by Maricela's answer because she answers that she's really hoping to get a private scholarship to the University of Denver. It's her one hope. You know, she's already been through the discovery that she won't qualify for a Pell Grant and she doesn't get in-state tuition in the state of Colorado. And so private dollars to go to this very prestigious school are perhaps her only chance. And clearly the hairdresser was expecting her to have lower expectations.
Yeah, and it's very hard because, again, she sees Clara and Alyssa not only having it much easier to get into these schools, but they have instantly scholarships, and it almost seems unfair that somehow a star shined on them in a different way.
You know, so I think readers can stand back and look at the choices that the parents made and think, oh, well, there's a reason that one girl's ending up in this predicament and one girl isn't. But you're exactly right that to these young people themselves, it feels so arbitrary. And at one point, Yadira kind of, who's Maricela's best friend and also undocumented, puts it into words when she says, I was so mad. We had the same kind of parents and the same kind of living, and we ate the same kind of food, and we listened to the same kind of music. How come they had their papers when I didn't? What did I do wrong?
And that's actually where the title of the book comes from.
Right.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yadira and Maricela felt really strongly that they were just like their two legal friends. And Clara and Alyssa felt equally strongly that Maricela and Yadira were just like them. So in the book title, it became Just Like Us. And I see that as a almost a question to the reader, who us is. Do these girls belong in America or not, in the reader's opinion? I mean, it's a very complicated subject. In the end, we might not all agree, but I think it's a fascinating and rich aspect of American society that many people don't really understand what it is to live an undocumented life. We talk about it a lot, but kind of in newspaper stories, we don't generally get a chance to delve down into the emotional experience of it and learn what that is.
Even the standard teenage rite of passion, getting one's driver's license, is much harder to come by.
Right. And the two undocumented girls in the book make really different choices in that instant. Yadira decides she will not drive at all since she can't qualify for a legal U.S. driver's license, Colorado license. Maricela, on the other hand, is determined to drive and goes out and buys a fake Mexican driver's license on the black market and goes around driving illegally.
Do they worry about getting caught when they have these fake papers?
I think they worry all the time, both about getting caught or somebody in their family getting deported. I think that sort of pervasive fear is something that hangs over them always. Interestingly, though, they can sometimes get lulled into a sense of complacency and feel like it's not going to happen to them. I remember Yadira, her mother was arrested when Yadira was a freshman in college. And it was very shocking to Yadira because she had just gotten into college and she was starting to feel a little more secure here. And suddenly her mother was arrested, and it was a brutal reminder that, oh, her family could be torn apart at any moment. Her life could be upended.
And her mother, interestingly, when they asked her when she was arrested, they said, well, do you have any children? Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the answer she gave?
Yeah. I thought this was such a telling moment. So she listed her legal children, and she omitted any mention of Yadira, who is her firstborn and perhaps the child to whom she is most close. But she didn't want to list her in that official moment in the courtroom speaking to American authorities because Yadira is the one child she has who was born in Mexico and who, like her mother, is living in the United States illegally, and she doesn't want to place her child in jeopardy by creating an official record about her. And she obviously is not mentioning her child, her first child, in order to protect Yadira, and yet it's so telling that she lists her children and doesn't mention one of them, that Yadira doesn't get to be listed.
Did Yadira fully understand that, or was she somehow hurt by it?
I think the person who noticed it and kind of read the emotional moment was Yadira's mentor, a woman named Irene Chavez in the book, which is not her real name, and none of the girls, these are not their real names. I did change the names of the individuals to protect them. But Yadira herself didn't point it out to me. It was the mentor who kind of observed that moment and felt a pang.
Now, they did all end up in college. Talk about how that happened for Maricela and Yadira.
Yeah. Well, this was the incredible drama of their senior year of high school, which I happened to show up just in time to catch. At the moment when I met them, Clara and Elissa were just receiving notices in the mail about all the different colleges that were happy to give them full ride tuition. And, of course, built into that was that they qualified for federal dollars, that they were eligible for Pell Grants. Yadira and Maricela didn't qualify for those federal dollars, but Yadira miraculously had managed to meet and impress a private benefactor who wanted to help raise money to pay her way for college. And shortly after I met the four young women, Maricela and Yadira learned about another opportunity, a Republican businessman who was giving scholarships to undocumented students around the state of Colorado. He's conservative. He's the largest donor to the Republican Party in the state of Colorado, but he has an immigrant background, really believes in education. So they both applied, and there's this terrible moment where they get the news that only one of them has won the scholarship. Yadira, again, has lucked out, gotten the money, and Maricela is the one out of all four girls who's about to be left behind. And she goes into this total sort of slump. I mean, she pretends to be happy at school and is very flashy and gregarious and talking about parties, but she's just heartbroken, and she doesn't understand how come Yadira has the wherewithal to surmount this incredible obstacle of illegality, and she can't figure out how to do it.
And there's a point at which both of them, sort of earlier on, interestingly, lost their motivation, thinking, well, if I've tried this hard and worked this long and it's not going to happen, then I'm just going to blow off school for a while.
That's right. At the moment when they learned that their friends, Clara and Elissa, were going to qualify for all these things and they weren't, they did both take a nosedive in school. Their grades dropped. They started cutting classes. They thought, if I'm just going to work at McDonald's or some fast food place, or if I'm just going to work in a grocery store, why would I keep trying so hard in school? And at that moment, Clara and Elissa kind of kicked into high gear and just pulled the other two girls back into high school. And I really think their friendships had a lot to do with why Maricela and Yadira did not give up in that moment. But it became complicated. It caused friction because Maricela and Yadira felt that their friends were, like, badgering them and hectoring them to come to class, and they didn't seem to understand exactly how bad it was if you didn't have documents. So the girls became kind of estranged from each other. Their friendships split up along lines of immigration status for a few months.
Go ahead.
Then at the end of high school, you know, when Yadira suddenly has figured out how to thread this really little needle, and Maricela can't figure it out, Yadira has this brainwave, and she decides to persuade one of her private benefactors that really she has this super bright friend, and she, Yadira, has too much money, and her friend, Maricela, has too little. Why doesn't one of her benefactors support Maricela instead? And it's quite amazing, but she manages to persuade the benefactor to do this, and so all four end up with the money to go to college.
It really is kind of an amazingly gutsy thing for her to do, and she is not a gregarious person the way Maricela is.
Right. The beauty of having four young women to write about is they're so different in temperament, in the choices they make in life, and Maricela and Yadira are almost opposites in terms of their personalities. Yadira is incredibly introverted and quiet, but she's a very deep thinker, and she's quite strong, but you don't know that at first because she doesn't ever say very much.
Journalist Helen Thorpe is my guest this hour. We're speaking about her new book, Just Like Us, the true story of four Mexican girls coming of age in America. We'll resume the conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Helen Thorpe. Her new book is called Just Like Us, the true story of four Mexican girls coming of age in America. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Helen, I want to talk for a minute about this party that I guess Yadira's and ultimately Maricela's benefactor gave, or one of the benefactors, for students that he was supporting. And there's an interesting sort of cultural, chasm between the people who are being helped and the people who are doing the helping. Everybody here means well, but there's an almost comical interaction between, this wife of the donor. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. It was a spectacularly it was an evening of spectacular differences. So the Republican businessman that I mentioned, who was funding undocumented students, hosted a gathering for the family, for the students and their families, and he is the person. Yadira is the student who won the money from him. Maricela also competed for it, but didn't get it in the end, and she wasn't there that evening. But Yadira came to the dinner with her mother, Alma, and Alma's father, Tomas. So Yadira's grandfather is there too, and they sit down at a table, and I sit down with them. And the donor himself and his wife joined us at the table, and so did a few university officials. And the donor's wife, who's a very socially adept woman with great social graces, immediately turned to Yadira's grandfather and attempted to engage him in conversation and was chatting about her recent trip to India. And she was saying, you know, it was really great. There were, you know, so many fewer beggars this time. I thought that was really wonderful. More people were working. And he sort of looked at her blankly, and a moment later it becomes clear in another interaction that he doesn't speak English, and neither does Yadira's mother. And the donor's wife sort of is very taken aback and says, oh my gosh, I was nattering away and nobody told me. He gave no indication. He was sort of masking his inability to comprehend anything she said. And it became clear suddenly in that moment just how hard it was for these different people to communicate, and also just how stratified our society is. This very wealthy couple who's helping this very bright young woman can't even speak to her family. They can't even interact with each other.
And then the girls' experiences when they got to their sort of dorm life experiences, they were surrounded suddenly by largely middle and upper middle class students who didn't have the kinds of worries that they had.
Yes, and it was a totally different environment than the one they were used to operating in. Their high school was 86% Latino, largely free and reduced lunch, so lower income. And suddenly they were in a really different environment in college. And they were occasionally having very awkward, hurtful interactions with very well-meaning students who didn't intend to hurt their feelings but were saying odd things to them, like there's a moment when Maricela doesn't get dressed up one evening for dinner. She just wears sweatpants and her hair is in a ponytail, and she's standing on one side of the salad bar helping herself to some food, and a student on the other side of the salad bar leans over and says to her, thanks so much for making the food. And he thinks he's being really kind to the server, and he's making this awful mistake of thinking that because Maricela has dark skin, she must be a server like all the other Spanish-speaking, dark-skinned people in the kitchen. And those kind of moments happened, and also in their classes, Maricela and Yadira were often asked by the professors to kind of speak for all lower-income people or to speak for all Latinos. So they became pretty uncomfortable.
And then on the other side of the coin, it's really poignant when Maricela goes home, and by this point her family has moved, I guess, to Arizona, and she really is struck for the first time about how much they're struggling to get by.
Yeah, it had been a big argument in her family whether Maricela would live in the college dorm. Her family had wanted her to live at home, and she had really fought for her independence and said she really wanted to experience college life and had moved into a college dorm. And then her family did relocate to Arizona, and she traveled back there to visit them, which was quite complicated for her to get from Colorado to Arizona without legal ID. She managed only when her mom drove all the way to pick her up and drove back down because she couldn't fly and was scared to take a bus in case she encountered a checkpoint and was deported. She gets there to Arizona, and she's just immediately struck by the difference between the comfortable lifestyle she'd been leading for several months back in the dorm, which is modern and stylish and fashionable and very comfortable. And now her family, her family, there's four kids in the family and two parents, so it's a six person family, and they're squished into a two bedroom apartment, and you know, living on top of each other and taking turns in the beds, and her parents are very worried and struggling to pay the bills, and it's kind of this visceral shock to her to walk back into the life of poverty that that she had known well before, and it was so familiar to her, she hadn't noticed it in the same way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour to Helen Thorpe about her new book, Just Like Us, the true story of four Mexican girls coming of age in America. Let's go first on the lines to Ed in Flower Mound. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Chris. Just love your show.
Thank you.
The thing that I wanted to ask about is if the situations were reversed, and your author was an illegal person in Mexico, and either she was a student or the parent, what are her thoughts on what she would be entitled to?
Helen?
Yeah, I think this question of entitlement is very interesting, and I appreciate that Ed raises it. One could look at Maricela and Yadira and ask, why do they feel entitled to have other people pay for a college education for themselves in the United States of America when they're not living here legally? And I think it's an excellent question. And I think the answer to me is that the reason they have those expectations is that they're watching their best friends acquire those things, and they're wondering, why are they different? Why don't they count as much in American society? And the answer, of course, is that because their parents made certain choices for them back when they were 3 or 7 that were not legal choices. But the difficult thing, the reason that I think it's such an interesting moral predicament to look at, is that they themselves didn't make those choices. They didn't choose to be here. They didn't decide to walk across the border without papers. So they find themselves in an unequal status in our society through a situation that is of their parents' making, not theirs. And I just think that's a fascinating thing to look at, but it's an excellent question.
Let's talk for a minute about the DREAM Act, which has been proposed in Congress in different iterations multiple times. It's sort of back again being debated. Talk about what that would change.
The DREAM Act is a piece of legislation that is periodically introduced that would kind of solve this situation of young people who are brought here not of their own volition and come of age in this country. It would offer them a path to citizenship, which does not currently exist for them. Our laws say if you cross the border illegally or if your parents brought you here without the right documents, you may not change your legal status without returning to your country of origin and applying from there. So the DREAM Act would instead offer young people a way to get into the legal pipeline to become eligible to apply for citizenship without leaving this country, and would also allow them to qualify for Pell Grants and in-state tuition. So it has huge numbers of adherents. There are, you know, there's like a DREAM Act page on Facebook with tens of thousands of people supporting it. I think that there's some question within the immigrant rights movement about whether it would be better to push for comprehensive immigration reform and try and argue for a path to citizenship for everyone who's living here without documents, or whether it would be better just to address the situation of young people through the DREAM Act.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next on the line to Rosa in Dallas. Hi, Rosa.
Hi, my name is Rosa. I just want to note that I'm shaking as I make this call. I was brought in when I was 3 years old. I am 28 now. I was fortunate enough that I could go to a school, to the University of North Texas. I have a bachelor's degree, and I cannot work. I do low-wage jobs. I have no recollection of Mexico. I pay my taxes, and there seems to be this really huge disconnect, like you spoke about, with the DREAM Act not being passed. As I know, the U.S. spent a lot of money on my education since I was in kindergarten. And then in my university education, I was fortunate enough to have grants given to me because they were state-funded for 5 years. And today I work minimum wage, and I know I'm not, I'm almost not complaining because I know I'm so fortunate and I have a bachelor's, but it just, there seems to be a really big disconnect. And to Ed, I say, you know, I feel no entitlement. I just hope that people can see that all we're trying to do is work hard, do our best, and just move on forward with our situation. I feel American, but I have no rights of a citizen or a resident, and I have no rights as a Mexican-American either. I will take my question off, or my comment off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I really appreciated that call because I just, what I hear in that young woman's voice is somebody with no trace of a Mexican accent. I hear somebody who grew up in this country who feels culturally American, who had the time to come of age while the rest of us were arguing over whether she and her family should or should not be here. But the fact is she was, and it sounds like she's been here for 25 years. And she feels some regret, and I feel some regret that our society has put dollars into her education, and yet we're not realizing the full potential of that. We're not able to embrace her in our society and say you should be able to work at a professional job and give back to our society. And she's sort of stuck in this limbo. I think we have a lot of people in this situation, and we're going to have to figure out as a society what to do about that.
Culturally, how did the girls that you profiled feel about their identity?
This was the question that hung over them, and it became, I think, perhaps the main theme of the book. They were asking themselves that in different ways all the time. Yadira, brought over at the exact same age as our caller at the age of 3, was always puzzling over, what was she? Like, she would say, you know, it's so weird. I don't have any memories of Mexico. I know everybody thinks I'm Mexican, but I don't know that country. And I know I'm not supposed to be here. I know I'm illegitimate here, but this is the only country I know, so I really feel American. In the end, I think they're hybrid creatures. They're the product of belonging and not belonging at the same time in our society.
And you have a very sort of different set of circumstances, but your parents were Irish, and you came to this country as a very young child and ultimately became a naturalized American.
Right. When I first met Yadira and Maricela, I imagined that we had a lot in common. I think over the years we spent together, I learned an awful lot about their lives that showed me really how much gentler my experience in the world had been and how privileged I was in many ways. My parents arrived speaking English as their native language. They had professional degrees. We were always in the middle class. We didn't struggle. But when I met Maricela and Yadira, what I felt we had in common was the fact that we were all the oldest in our families. We had the identical birth order, so we were the ones who were born somewhere else before our parents moved here. And then I also had in common with Yadira that experience of being brought to this country during a period of time where I was too young to form memories. So I grew up in this country with a green card, but this was the only country I could ever remember living in. So I shared that sort of odd dissonance with her of wondering, well, how come I'm the one with a green card? That's kind of weird. Like, I only remember this place. But I do think in the end, you know, the fact that visually I look like so many other people in this country, given the enormous numbers of Irish immigrants that came long ago, I just didn't stand out or register as an immigrant in the way that these young women, I think, do. And so my experience was ultimately very different than theirs.
How did things go for Yadira and for her sisters after their mother was deported?
Initially, I wondered if the story really was just all about access to college. And at first, I wasn't even imagining writing a book. I thought maybe it would be a magazine story about the question of whether all four of these young women would make it into college. And I could stayed in touch with them after they were in college, and it was that moment when Yadira's mother, Alma, was arrested that it became clear to me that this story wasn't done, that this was an ongoing drama, and we were only partway through. Ultimately, in the years that followed, and I spent 5 years with Yadira and Maricela from the time they were 17 to 22, and towards the end of that time, you saw the real impact of Alma's absence start to play out. Yadira had always thought that her legal-born siblings, her U.S.-born siblings, were going to lead much easier lives than she, and she was the one who was going to suffer the most. And actually the opposite happened, which was a tremendous surprise to her. She's the one who ended up with a college degree, and her sisters so far have failed to go to college. Their lives really went off track when their mother was arrested and fled to Mexico and left them here. They spent their teenage years, their end of high school years, here in this country without a parent. Their dad had abandoned the family when they were young, and their mother fled to Mexico. So by the very end of the book, one of Yadira's sisters is now living on the floor of Yadira's college dorm room because she doesn't have anywhere else to live. And I thought it was such a tragedy to see these two sisters who did have documents, who could qualify for Pell Grants, who could do all those things that Yadira couldn't do, to watch them not take advantage of their opportunities.
Journalist Helen Thorpe is my guest. We're speaking this hour about her new book, Just Like Us, the true story of four Mexican girls coming of age in America. We'll resume the conversation in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Helen Thorpe, who has written for The New Yorker and for Texas Monthly. Her new book is called Just Like Us, the true story of four Mexican girls coming of age in America. We'll go back to the phones now and this time speak with Doug in Dallas. Hi, Doug.
Hi, Chris. How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Hello, Ms. Thorpe. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm enjoying this discussion immensely.
Excellent.
I have a heart. And I also have a mind, and my heart cries out to those girls who were here illegally. As you pointed out, it was not of their own volition that they came here. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, an illegal act was committed. We have some criminals on our hands, and I think the one girl's mother realized that when she fled back to Mexico. I think the girls should be allowed to get their education. I mean, they've done what is kind of an amnesty thinking line in the sense that they've done what they need to do to prove that they want to be here in this country and to be citizens of this country and to contribute to this country. So once again, the legality of it has skipped a generation, and whereas the parents are the actual criminals, the children are the ones who are suffering. And it's a very emotional issue, I understand that, but it's also one that is really legally cut and dried. If you are here illegally, you are here illegally. If we had an Arab terrorist who came over here and became embedded in our society, and he brought his family with him, all right, what would the feeling be about educating that terrorist child?
What do you think about that? Thank you so much for your call, Doug. What do you think, Helen?
Well, I really appreciate the fact that Doug could speak so eloquently about both the reaction of your heart and your mind to this predicament. And I think what he's saying is that, you know, he's incredibly sympathetic to the plight of the children, but he can't ignore that their parents really did break our laws. And we have been so stuck as a society around this issue, and I think until we can reach a reasonable person like Doug, who's calling in and speaking so eloquently about his different reactions to this, until he becomes part of the consensus, we're going to remain stuck, because there are people arguing, oh, immigrants are wonderful for this country, let's give them all amnesty, and there's other people saying we really need to deport everybody. But it's the reasonable people in the middle who are going to have to agree on whatever the solution is. And the one thing I would say in response or in addition to everything that Doug just said is the people who chose to cross the border illegally, the parents in this case, they're not the only people involved in creating a situation where we have large numbers of undocumented immigrants living in our society, or illegal aliens, whatever the term is you want to use. There also are American employers here, very willing to hire. And those American employers, I don't think, are generally bad people who want to facilitate other people breaking the law or want to break the law themselves. You think they haven't been given the right tools to be able to determine who's here legally and who's here not. So we've had this situation where we've been happy to take the labor of the parents of people like Maricela and Yadira, and yet we keep talking about how the fact that we don't want these folks in our society. And it's just hypocritical. If we accept the labor of immigrants, then we've got to embrace their kids. They're part of our society. That's the way I feel. If we don't want to take their labor, then we can exclude those people from our society. But as long as we're giving them jobs, we ourselves are part of the issue.
Of course, a lot of people who oppose illegal immigration worry that people who have broken one law will break another. And I want to step back here and talk a little bit about your personal story. In addition to being a freelance journalist, you are the wife of the mayor of Denver, John Hickenlooper, who is now running for governor of Colorado. And so his business affairs tend to be big news. Can you tell us about what happened with Raul Gomez Garcia in 2005?
This is the moment when this book radically changed. In my mind, before this moment, it was really going to be a book just about the four students that we've been discussing, and I was never going to address in the pages of the book who I was married to or what the political circumstances were. And then in the moment when Raul Gomez Garcia committed a terrible crime here in Denver, suddenly the lives of the four students that I was writing about intersected with my own personal set of circumstances, and in the end, I had to incorporate all this material in the book if I was going to write the book at all. So Gomez Garcia is another person who was brought to this country at a young age without documents. Unlike the four girls that I write about, I mean, they're at one end of the extreme in terms of the amount of education they've received. He's at the other. Unlike the four girls, Gomez Garcia hardly spent any time in school. He is 19 at the time when he commits this crime, and he can't read or write. He's working as a dishwasher. He's presented fake documents, and he's been invited to a social club in Denver to a baptismal party. He leaves his wife and child there. He goes away, picks up some guy friends, comes back, and two police officers won't let him re-enter, because he can't produce the piece of paper that says he should legitimately be there, and the club has become crowded. Officers have been asked to turn people away. He has some kind of exchange with the cops, and he leaves, go gets a gun, comes back, shoots both police officers in the back, killing one who happens not to be wearing a bulletproof vest. The other officer's wearing a vest, and he survives. That already was enough to send the city of Denver into convulsions, but it got worse in the days that followed, because it emerged that Gomez Garcia, who's undocumented, was working at a restaurant that's owned in part by a group of investors, in part by my husband. So suddenly you had the mayor of Denver in a situation where he had placed his assets in a trust, but they were still his assets, and he was one of the investors who had invested in this restaurant that was employing this guy who shot the cops. So it became a huge political scandal. It was all over talk radio. And Maricela was invited to the party. Her boyfriend ended up going. Her family ended up going. She got in a fight with her boyfriend. She didn't go herself. But there really wasn't any way for me to write about Maricela and not address what happened that night.
What is the takeaway for you when you compare these two very different stories of immigration in America?
You know, in the end, I felt that that to have written only about four straight-A students, all of whom, no matter what their status was, found a way to pay for college, would have been to focus only on one type of undocumented young person. And the fact that Gomez-Garcia kind of thrust himself into this story that I was trying to tell and, you know, couldn't be ignored. I felt I couldn't ignore him. In the end, you know, he's a very different type of undocumented person, and he might be the type of person that, say, the opponents of immigrants being here might hold up as an example of who these immigrants are, whereas immigrant rights advocates might hold up the four students and say, no, no, they're these kind of people. But in the end, you know, immigrants are us. I mean, they're everything under the sun. I mean, all the people who've come from Mexico, you can't say they're all one thing or all another. They're a large, enormous group of individuals living here, and they represent everything under the sun in terms of personality and temperament or moral behavior. And every once in a while, you're going to get somebody who's capable of heinous things, just like Gomez-Garcia, and I don't think that can be ignored.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the line to Michael in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
I have a question for the your guest, and the question is, would she agree with the statement that of providing education opportunities and assistance for these young people is really an investment in our country, and that it's not a question of whether they're here legally or not, or whether they have documentation, but it's an investment in young people, it's an investment in our country, and particularly since we always honor the merit, personal accomplishments, personal achievements, and academic excellence. So I think that it's not a matter of entitlement when we talk about providing educational opportunities for these young people, and I would like to know what your guest thinks about that statement.
My response would be, it is our federal law, it's gone up to the Supreme Court, it's been argued in the Supreme Court, that we will invest in every child growing up in this country, regardless of immigration status. The kids are not responsible for the fact that they're here. The Supreme Court has ruled that anybody growing up in this country, we will, as a society, invest in their education. And in that Supreme Court ruling, you see the language that explains why this is critical, because as a society, we don't want to create a subclass of people who lack education. It's not wise. We're investing in the education of all children in this country because we want a society in which people have the opportunity to work. If we create a subclass of people without education who can't compete for jobs, you know, we, in the language of the Supreme Court decision, it predicts that we would be creating a class of people who would be more prone to crime.
Can you talk, I don't know if you're comfortable with this, I don't think it takes anything away from the drama of the book, to talk about how the girls are doing now. Can you sort of fill us in?
So by the end of the book, I think all four young women have achieved pretty extraordinary things, considering particularly all the difficulties that they had. And you've seen Maricela grow into a leader, both on her college campus and politically. She's given speeches to huge numbers of people at demonstrations and things like that. By the end of the book, she has graduated from college, and she is aspiring to become a lawyer. She wants to go to law school. And of course, this is incredibly ironic. Here you have an illegal immigrant who wants to pursue legal studies. But if you actually step inside of Maricela's shoes, it makes perfect sense because she's been bumping up against laws for years now, and she's hungry to learn how can she be one of the people who learns how to change them or amend them or argue about them in a court of law. But she can't figure out how she would get the dollars together for law school. So she's sort of facing the same predicament at a later juncture in life that we saw her facing when the book began. She's wondering, how can she possibly pursue her dreams given her lack of a legitimate Social Security number? All four of the girls miraculously to me make it through college because Yadira in particular I think was under tremendous stress throughout this time, but she hangs in there and finishes college. And Maricela and Yadira wind up being lucky enough to get a job to get jobs at a nonprofit that works on immigrant rights. So they're no longer doing service work, unlike the caller earlier in the program who is doing service work with a bachelor's degree. They've actually figured a way out of that predicament. So they feel very fortunate, even though they feel that they can't realize their full dreams or their full potential.
And you were sort of surprised by Clara's career direction.
Clara...
Was it Clara or Alyssa that surprised you?
Oh, yes. Okay, I was going to say Clara's interested in becoming a social worker. Alyssa, I had kind of envisioned this.
And I'm so sorry to do this.
Business classes.
We have about 15 seconds left.
Okay,
sorry.
She took marketing, but she ended up deciding she wants to become a teacher. And I was surprised. She wants to work with, you know, students like the ones that I was meeting back when they were young.
Well, it sounds like she's certainly got the experience to do it at this point. Helen Thorpe is a freelance journalist who has previously written for The New Yorker and Texas Monthly. Her new book is called Just Like Us, The True Story of Four Mexican Girls Coming of Age in America. Helen, it's been a really fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you. It's really been a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.